despite all of the dire problems that we face today, I come increasingly sensing that there is great hope for social progress and among social movements not only in the United States, but in the rest of the world. Now, I've spent now 40 years working as a journalist, earning my living as a journalist, not as a political analyst. Or I've done quite a bit of work in terms of understanding the history of different institutions and groups with which I have grown up with throughout my life. And we just celebrated a few weeks ago the 50th anniversary of the Columbia student strike, of which I was a participant back in 1968. And I was able to spend about 10 years before I became a professional journalist as a social and community activist in a variety of organizations, not just the Students for Democratic Society, but then the Young Lords Party, the National Congress for Puerto Rican Rights, the African Liberation Support Committee. Even as I continued working as a professional journalist, I had the opportunity at different stages in my journey through journalism to help organize my fellow journalists in labor actions, surprisingly, all of which turned out to be pretty successful. We had in 1985 a 5-week strike in Philadelphia at the Philadelphia Daily News and Philadelphia Inquirer, where we won, I think, the last great contract of any newspaper union in America back in 1985. A few years later, in 1990-91, I had the good fortune or bad fortune to have been involved and be a strike leader of the New York Daily News strike, which lasted for 5 months, and which we also somehow managed to defeat one of these giant media companies, the Tribune Company. And then, of course, back in 2000-2001, the big battle we had at Pacifica to try to prevent the corporate takeover of Pacifica, which lasted over a year. Won for that period of time. Things have changed over the years, but at least it was able to prevent that. So I've had the good fortune to have participated in many mass struggles over the years, which have managed to win their goals. Back in 1968, we all thought a new world was dawning in 1968 and 69. We thought the revolution was just around the corner. As Paul has mentioned, capitalism has proven to be an amazingly resilient system. We always had the argument, does the base determine the superstructure, or superstructure determine base? Well, capitalism has always been able to figure out its threats to it and come up with new ways to maintain its power. And of course, it was helped along the line by the collapse of the socialist experiments of the 40s, 50s, and 60s, and opening up all these new markets that previously had been shut off to to world capitalist development. So I think that I've tried to deal with my own ability to be involved in these struggles and somehow win immediate success against the larger problem that we all face, that the capitalist system has continued to become more entrenched throughout the world. And so that would seem to indicate a pessimistic analysis. Well, I think one of the things that is most important to grab hold of, I always have this argument with Amy Goodman, my co-host of Democracy Now! And others. I believe the most important thing that happened in the 20th century was that the people of Asia, Africa, and Latin America stood up. Colonialism, the old system of colonialism, was ended in the 20th century. Now, it happened because and this is my own analysis, some historians might differ with me on this, the necessity of all of the various imperialist nations when they went into World War II to win the war required them to draft their colonial subjects into their armies. and required them to go to the colonies and come up with more soldiers to fight. As a result, you see, if anyone who studies the civil rights movement in the United States, who studies the rise of the Mexican-American and Puerto Rican movement in the United States, that studies the rise of the anti-colonial movements around the world, realizes that it was many of the colonial soldiers who fought in World War II who came back to the colonies and demanded the same kinds of freedom and independence that Europe and the United States were espousing. So that the necessity to impress the colonial subjects into World War II laid the basis for the independence movements that arose afterwards, whether it was in India or in Algeria or throughout much of Asia, Africa, and Latin America. And then something else started to happen. The Third World started coming to the West. After World War II, you started having all of these mass flows of people from those colonies to the colonizer nations. What is the main thing propelling most of the fascist movements in the advanced capitalist world today? It's anti-immigrant fervor, anti-immigrant xenophobia. In France, they don't know what to do about all the Tunisians and the Moroccans and the Algerians. In England, they don't know what to do about all the Pakistanis, Indians, and Jamaicans. In Germany, they don't know what to do about all the Turks. In the United States, they don't know what to do about all the Latin Americans and Caribbeans and others from the Third World that have come to the West. When you look at the immigrant flows, the people have come precisely from the nations that once were their colonial masters. The reason there are so many Algerians, Tunisians, and Moroccans in France is because those were the colonies of France. The reason there's so many Pakistanis, Indians, and Jamaicans in England is because those were the colonies of England. And the reason there are so many Latin Americans in the United States, no matter what Trump or any of the others say, is because Latin America was the incubator of the American overseas empire. It was where all the great multinational companies were first born in Latin America. So what we have seen increasingly is that the Third World has come to the West and has totally begun to transform the actual compositions of these nations. And as a result, there's an increasing backlash from the old members of those nations. Who is a Frenchman? Who is an Englishman? Who is an Englishman? Who is a German? Even who is a Swede today? And so there are all of these battles, and people are trying to grab onto the past when it cannot be grabbed onto. Unfortunately, what has happened increasingly as migrant flows have moved the Third World into the West, there is now a whole new consciousness, I believe, in the working class of these countries. Who is the working class? But not the working class that you see on TV. Saying that they're all Trump supporters. Who is the real working class of America today? The people who are doing the hardest work, and you find that there's been enormous transformation of the working classes of these countries, and I think this is what is fueling the rise of this new fascist movement, this unease, this sense of fear that the nation that they once knew is changing and has to be stopped. It can't be stopped, of course, because you cannot have a capitalist world where you increasingly break down barriers for capital flows while you erect walls and barriers for labor. You cannot do that. If you are going to reduce the barriers for capital, you must also reduce the barriers for labor to be able to move freely around the world. So I think that's the big picture. Now, let me get quickly to what I think is what you're looking for more is in terms of strategy. I've spent 40 years now as a journalist basically covering urban America, covering life in urban America, politics in urban America, land policies, tax policies, political leadership. So I think I have gotten a fairly good grasp over the years of what is happening in urban America. And I believe that the key to progressive and radical change increasingly is in our cities. Now, you've got to keep your eye on the national and the state and do the best you can to affect change there. But the reality is that throughout the advanced capitalist world, national governments and regional governments are increasingly growing right wing. And however, the cities, which are much more diverse and inclusive and hold the majority of the populations of all of these countries, are increasingly going to the left because they are responding to grassroots movements that have developed in many of these cities. And that's part of what I try to talk about in Reclaiming Gotham, how this movement post Great Recession, post-Occupy, there's been a phenomenal growth of radical and progressive grassroots movement, electing people to office, then getting into key positions at office and actually practicing a different type of governance. Because you can criticize capitalist system and the problems of the capitalist system all day long. You have to have a vision of how you would govern differently, what you would do differently. And we have lots of examples of failures of progressive and socialist and left-wing thinking. So we've got to actually be able to provide examples of progressive and radical governance that actually improve the lives of people. So whether it's Anne Hidalgo in Paris, or Ada Colau in Barcelona, or Sadiq Khan in London, or Gail McLaughlin in California, or Chukwuma Lumumba in Jackson, or Raz Baraka in Newark, or Bill de Blasio here. And I'm not saying that they don't have their problems, every one of them. But the reality is you have movements that have developed, progressive movements that are beginning to seize power in these cities and provide a different perspective and vision of how you can govern. So I think that's the first thing. Local struggles that hold people accountable and gain power and show examples of progressive governance at the local level. Second is build the broadest possible unity among progressives. I remember back in 1968 when we were in SDS and it was Nixon running against Humphrey. And of course, no one liked Humphrey. But we in SDS had the slogan, vote in the streets, vote with your feet. Do not vote in that election. Do not vote. So many of the left boycotted the 1968 election. In retrospect, I think it was one of my biggest mistakes in terms of what Nixon represented from then on as the beginning of the right-wing onslaught that went on for years. So I think that there were other examples over those years of the sectarianism of some of us on the left that refuse to recognize that we can have differences with folks, but treat them with respect and try to find the unities that we can have with anyone who is seeking to build a better life, and that we can find a way to look for the unities first and not for the differences. So I think that the first key issue of any, key point of any strategy is one, build local grassroots movement and effectively govern. Two, build the broadest possible unity you can. And then the final critical dividing line between liberals or progressives and radicals is, do you oppose empire? Do you oppose imperial wars of your own government? Do you oppose your own governments continuing to attack and intervene in other countries? And do you oppose the restoration of white supremacy? That those are, to me, the key issues. Build a strong local base. Make the revolution locally first before you try to make it nationally. Two, build the broadest possible unity. And three, oppose imperial war, impose empire of your own government. Not that you could oppose other governments, but the key thing is oppose your own government's attempts to build empire. And to me, those are the three key points that I hope you will take away for whatever strategy you believe out of this conference is the one that you're going to pursue. Thank you.